Welcome back again to BadQuaker.com. Today we have an interview with Elizabeth Higgs. Elizabeth is a wife and a mother, is active in her church. She's the author of a moving article I read on Bad Quaker. No, at LouRockwell.com a couple of years back. We have it linked here at Bad Quaker on where this article appears. She also recently wrote an article that appeared in World Magazine and on the website for the Independent Institute that it was just a wonderful article. Elizabeth is also the wife of the prominent economist and leader of the Austrian tradition of economics, Robert Higgs. Long before Rahm Emanuel proclaimed, quote, you never want a serious crisis to go to waste, Bob Higgs described what he called the ratchet effect in his book Crisis and Leviathan. Bob explained how the state uses every crisis, no matter how big or small, to expand its power and its influence. And Bob explained that although the state may appear to pull back sometimes, it will never pull back as much as it advances towards total control. Bob has been and continues to be a great influence in economic thought and in explaining the nature of the state. Elizabeth, welcome to BadQuaker.com. I'm just so pleased that you decided to come on and do an interview with us.
It's nice to talk to you.
Your article on Lou Rockwell that I mentioned earlier, I believe it was from 2008, and it was about a lady named Lavina Johnson. She was a U.S. Army private that was brutally murdered while serving in Iraq. The crime was worsened by the government lying to Lavina's family and falsifying the details of her death, including calling it a suicide and even stooping so low as to alter the pictures of her. And they glued her gloves onto her dead body to hide the evidence. As far as I can find out, the government has systematically refused to reopen this case. Elizabeth, do you know if the government has yet accepted any responsibility for its actions in covering up this horrible crime?
They have never reopened the investigation into her death. I don't believe that they ever will reopen the investigation. It's been... I wrote that article in 2008. She was murdered in 2005. So it's been 6 years. I'm assuming that her family hasn't given up, but I don't really see much cause for hope that the government will in any way revisit her death. It's not in their interest to do so.
Yeah. I remember when I very first read that at Lou Rockwell, it upset me so bad. Even now, it's upsetting me. But I remember reading that and just stopping what I was doing, closing down the internet, and going out in my garden because I was so upset. I just couldn't even think. I just needed peace.
Well, I initially had read just a straight news account of her story, and it really infuriated me. And so I sent an email to Lou Rockwell and said, why don't you write about this? And he wrote me back and said, why don't you write about this? And it's one of those things, I don't write a lot, but I tend to be inspired to write when something I come across just is filled with so much injustice that I feel like if I don't cry out that, I'm not doing what I'm supposed to be doing. And that's why I wrote about her, because what happened to her was, the worst thing that you could possibly imagine happening to one of your children. And I just have so much sympathy for her family and so much disdain for the military, for how they treat their soldiers, even after death. It's despicable.
It really is. I can't even allow my mind to flow in that direction, because the details are just so horrific, I can't even begin to speak about them. But the fact that they would lie the way they did, for whatever happened in her actual death, to have them covered up like that is just... And here's the worst part. It doesn't surprise me. not so much that it's the military, but it's just the government, the way governments function. It just doesn't surprise me, and I should be surprised. I should be shocked, and instead, I'm just angered so bad by it.
I know, and there's some things that they do that are so typical, and yet at the same time, you are surprised. Like, I was surprised that they gave her a posthumous promotion to private first class.
Yeah.
It's so gross. It's disgusting. And it's like a bone, like I wrote in the article. It's a bone they threw to her family. And I'm just so grateful that her parents were smart enough to see through what the Army was doing and, you know, and so that they could know the truth about what had really happened to their daughter.
Yeah. This works right into the other article that you wrote that appeared over at World and at the Independent Institute. You know, when we see the government do something like that and we think, well, you know, I can't really make this argument, but I'm sure there's somebody who somewhere can say, well, there's probably this reason or there's that reason why this was covered up or whatever. But, you know, the state didn't actually kill her. This was somebody else who did this, the murder itself. But when you look at the what you wrote, the topic that you wrote about for the other article, this is a case where the state specifically took its time, very carefully planned out the murder of two human beings, one of which was almost positively guilty of murder himself. The other, there's some question about it one way or the other. Some would argue in both directions. But it almost doesn't matter the details of why these men were murdered by the state. It's just the fact that the state has now put its hands, has bloodied its hands once again in this case. And then the stunning part of your article was, that really struck me, was the family, the Byrd family, and their reaction to this.
Well, last Wednesday, and I don't really think I'll ever forget that day, I had been following the Troy Davis case for a while, and on Wednesday, I kept hoping against hope that someone would have the moral courage to step forward and do something to help this man, because there had been such doubts cast on his guilt, and I don't know if he was innocent of the killing or not, but I do know that I don't believe that even a preponderance of the evidence at that point could have merited giving him the death penalty, and so the idea that they were going to go ahead and put this man to death when so much doubt had been cast on his guilt seemed just crazy to me. And I, of course, am opposed to the death penalty on principle, and I'm opposed to the death penalty for two reasons. The first reason in this case is because the state too often puts innocent people to death. And some people will say, well, we don't know that. But we do know that, because we know now, because of the work done by the Innocence Project and other groups, that there are so many people on death row who are not guilty of the crimes of which they have been convicted and
right.
sentenced to death. And to assume that we have not put innocent people to death, to me, is just an outrageous idea. It's obvious we've put innocent people to death.
Yeah.
And when Wednesday, when Troy Davis was supposed to be executed, I believe it was 6 o'clock. I can't remember if it was 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock here. He was supposed to be, I live in Central Time, he was supposed to be executed, and they announced that the Supreme Court was discussing his appeal. And time dragged on and on. I think it was almost 4 hours before they came out and said that that they were not going to hear his appeal and that they were denying it. And I just had – I was watching the television, and I don't normally watch the television news because it's revolting. And so – but this story was so important to me that I had on the news. Mm-hmm. And I had on CNN, and Anderson Cooper was on, and he had on his show the mother of the murder victim, Mark MacPhail. And I have a tremendous amount of sympathy for her, and I do not want to sound in any way like I think that she's some kind of horrible person.
Right.
I don't believe that.
Right.
But I believe that Troy Davis had become so dehumanized in their eyes that it was now just an inconvenience that this time was being taken to decide whether they were going to actually put him to death or not. And she said something like, I just wish they would just get this over with. And I remember being struck because this was a man's life that we were talking about.
Yeah.
And when he was about to be put to death, and he picked his head up and looked straight at the family members who were there and said that that he was sorry for what had happened to them, but that he did not commit the crime. And I was so crushed. I was so crushed that they did put him to death. And I started reading the next day about the other execution. And this was the story of James Byrd, who had been killed by Lawrence Brewer and two other men in what we down here, you know, I live in the Deep South in Louisiana, it was a lynching. I mean,
right,
he was dragged
right.
behind a car to death, but still, that's a lynching here.
Yeah, and it was racially motivated, and the individual found guilty of the crime was just a horrific, nasty monster of a human being.
Yes, he was very, 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 extremely troubled, hate-filled person.
Mm-hmm.
And there was absolutely no doubt of his guilt. He did not try to hide his guilt. In fact, he bragged about his crime.
Right.
But what I was struck by when I was reading this was the dichotomy between the reaction of the family of James Byrd, who had been murdered in Texas, and the family of Mark MacPhail, of the man who had been murdered in Georgia.
Yeah.
And the difference was so stark. And what I ended up feeling was such sympathy for the MacPhail family in Georgia, because they didn't understand that peace does not come from killing people.
Right.
And I don't believe they're psychopaths, right?
Right.
The only way peace does come from killing is if you are a psychopath.
Mm.
And I don't believe his family en masse is psychopathic.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that this was something that they must not have had presented to them. I don't know this for a fact, but I wonder what kind of spiritual counseling that they received, not to understand what it was that the Byrd family in Texas understood, which was that peace comes through forgiveness. And it, the whole thing to me was just really heart-wrenching on both sides. It was really hard.
Well, within the human mind, you know, anger is such a powerful, powerful force, and it's so close to hate. You know, they're very different things. Anger and hate are two very vastly different things. But within the realm of emotion, they're so close to each other that it's so easy to fall from one to the other. And any time that either anger or hate fill the mind, logic is just pushed right out, you know? And so, you know, whether we're talking about the hate and the anger that the racist man had who murdered this poor guy, or the anger that turns to hate that's in the family, wanting to see what they think, what they perceive as justice, and then it pushes logic out, and it causes them to make this. And I'm not a psychiatrist or a psychologist, so I'm just making this up out of my own experiences. But it seems to me that it pushes any trace of reason out. And it creates this imaginary thing in your mind that you imagine to be justice. And you think, well, as soon as the state kills that guy, I'll have my justice. But, you know, how can that be? That's like I can't think of anything to compare it to, because it's such a breach of logic that killing another person is somehow going to bring you the peace that you're really desiring, because that's what they want. They want peace. They want this to end.
Right. Well, what I see this as, and what happened in the news today about the Americans who were murdered by the U.S. forces in Yemen, mm-hmm. the American citizens who were murdered, what I see this as the systematic dehumanization of people by the state.
Sure.
And if you are on death row, everything about death row is set up to dehumanize you.
Mm-hmm.
If you believe that this person is guilty of the crime against your family member, then you're going to buy into the dehumanization of the killer. The same thing goes with the public reaction to the killing of the Americans in Yemen.
Mm-hmm.
I don't doubt that these two guys who were killed did awful, terrible things.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, that idea is completely separate and apart from what is justice. But we have so dehumanized everyone that is over there in that area of the world
mm-hmm.
that so many people in this country actually cheerlead the killing over there and think that killing is good. And I can't go there. That's not a place where I can go.
Mm-hmm.
My grandfather was a person who always pulled for the little guy, and he would you know, I grew up that I was supposed to pull for the little guy.
Yeah.
I'm not supposed to pull for the Yankees.
Mm-hmm.
I'm supposed to pull for the Cubs.
Right.
You see.
Right.
And so when I see these things where people are just where justice is simply thrown out of the window, and there is no mercy and no forgiveness, it really, really eats me up inside.
Yeah. The fact, though, that the Byrd family, back in your article, that they could come to a place of where they could actually say, you know, this is not what we want done. We don't want, we're not going to have any satisfaction in another death. It's not going to bring anything to us that we don't already have. And they were able to come to that place, you know, outside of the state to find that peace. Because their faith, their trust is not based in the state or the state's justice system or any activity of the state. It's based on a much higher level.
I believe that their theology trumps their ideology, and that's very uncommon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the reasons why we have liberal and conservative churches is because what guides people is not their theology, but their ideology. And you have to make a conscious choice to allow your theology to guide you.
Yeah.
And it appears from everything that I read and interviews that I saw with James Byrd's mother that she is a person who forced herself in the beginning to forgive the killer
mm-hmm.
because she knew that was what was required by her faith.
Yeah.
And so she didn't, it's not like she loved the guy. She didn't love the guy.
Right.
But she, in the beginning, was willing to forgive him because that's what she knew she was supposed to do. And for a lot of people, that's really a hard thing. And they might grasp onto some different aspect of the history of faith to justify killing a person instead, but her theology was all about agape, mm-hmm. and she embraced agape, and she forgave the killer. And by the time she died last year, her daughter said that her mother was at peace, and I'm so grateful that she was able to find that, because
yeah.
it is a very, very difficult thing for anybody to find. And to find it in the midst of having your son beaten up mercilessly,
yeah.
urinated upon, chained to the back of a truck and dragged for 3 miles, half of which he was alive, until his head hit a culvert and he was decapitated. And you know you're going to see this in your mind all the time if you are a member of his family.
Yeah.
And they saw this. They had to have relived this a million times.
Oh, yeah.
And each time you relive it, the anger will arise, and each time they forgave anew. Because forgiveness is like, you know, they talk about conversion. It's a continuing thing. It's not something you convert and then it's all done.
Yeah.
It's a continual turning, and forgiveness is the same way. So every time they would think of this crime, they would forgive anew, and I'm blown away by that. I find that whole family to be so outstanding and so humble and so amazing. It's just really amazing to me.
I hope I'm never tested in this, but as I sit today, I don't think I could pass that test.
Well, Bob and I made a pact. My husband and I made a pact that if either one of us was murdered, that we would do everything we could to make sure that our killer was not put to death.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I could reach the level of forgiveness that the Byrd family did. I hope that I could, and I pray that I could. I don't know, though, that I could, though, but I do know that I don't want somebody dying in answer to my death.
Yeah.
And so we have this pact now. Of course, we hope that neither one of us will ever be murdered, but, you know, it's something that we actually talked about.
Let me take this in a slightly different direction. We're talking quite a bit about faith. I was actually, up until about 2006 or so, I guess I can make excuses and say I never really thought through the concept of the death penalty and what the state's function in this was, and how that it's not actually justice, it's just a process of the state, and they just, you know, like you were saying, they dehumanize a person and they go through this process, and I didn't really think about it. I just took the, even though I've been a libertarian to some extent all my adult life, I never really thought the process through. And then around 2006 or so, I switched my entire thinking on this after seeing, oddly enough, a pair of atheists explaining to me why this was not the function of the state. That was Penn and Teller on their
right.
And I was struck at the time that a pair of atheists were taking the moral position, and I was taking the immoral position. And it just kind of blew my mind. I had to stop and reevaluate almost every aspect of what I believed and why I believed it. And I did not abandon my faith in that. I actually found a deeper aspect of my faith in doing it. And I certainly realized at that time that my faith was tied directly into my libertarian beliefs. And I was a libertarian because of my faith, and because of my, I don't even know how to describe it, but the two are almost the same thing. They're almost inseparable now that I really think it through. And maybe the easiest of all is to compare the Golden Rule to the Zero Aggression Principle. When I saw that this was the same thing, there's no difference. It just opened my eyes to this completely.
Well, I actually see it a little bit different. I don't see the non-aggression principle as being equivalent to the Golden Rule, at least as far as the Golden Rule is connected to Christianity. I see the non-aggression principle attached more to what they call the Silver Rule. You know about the Silver Rule. It's that which you do not wish men to do to you, do not do to them.
Mm.
To me, that is the non-aggression principle.
Mm-hmm.
To me, the Golden Rule, at least, and you know, the Golden Rule has a wide history. It's not something that is in the purview of just Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
But I am a Christian, And so when I think about the golden rule, I think about the fact that it requires me to act. It doesn't require me to just not bother somebody else or violate somebody else's rights, but it requires self-sacrifice on my part. And I do not believe that the non-aggression principle requires that.
No, that's great, because one is a do and the other is a don't do.
Exactly. And I like the don't do. I really do like the don't do. But the don't do is a cold world. It can be, anyway.
Yeah.
It can be a very cold world, because you can have a bunch of hermits living in a cave in the non-aggression principle. But the golden rule and the idea of loving your neighbor as yourself requires that you take positive steps to help other people. And to me, that is the best society. And it's not a society that is only espoused by Christianity. It's espoused by many faiths. It's carried out by none. But there are people who adhere to their faith and who do, to the best of their ability, follow the teachings of their faith. And those are the people that you recognize immediately as being holy people. You know, you just know, oh, that's a really holy person. And it's because they do embody this idea of openness, forgiveness, mercy, and love for the entire world, where they answer evil for good, where if someone comes up to them and says something horrible to them, they don't answer in kind. They answer with love instead. And that's a completely different world from the non-aggression principle.
Yeah, that's really profound. You've added tremendously to the conversation at badquaker.com. I appreciate that.
I'd like to go back for a minute, if I could, to our discussion about the death penalty. My daughter is in graduate school, and she has a friend on Facebook. And when Troy Davis was put to death, somebody on my daughter's Facebook page said that they didn't think that lethal injection was terrible. And her friend said that you shouldn't be fooled by the suave performance of the killing.
Wow.
And I found that to be profound, because that is what they have done, is they have created an antiseptic, completely antiseptic way of killing, with men in white coats, and they try and present it as a thing that is not horrible, as if the person sitting in the jail cell is saying, well, if they're going to put me to death, at least they're not going to fry me in the electric chair, which is not really what I think they're thinking in their cell when they're about to be put to death.
Yeah.
And so I just wanted to go back to that for a minute, if you didn't mind that I...
In a sense, and other people have made this argument, so I'm not inventing anything new here, but in a sense, it's been argued that if people actually saw the brutality of murdering, of taking eye for eye, and of murdering someone because they murdered, if they had to be the one that was there, you know, throwing a switch or doing the actual deed, then it might, at least for some people, it might cause a pause and cause them to say, well, you know, maybe not. And to a certain extent, I think when you think of something as horrific as, like, the way the guillotine was used in France, and the way hanging was used for so many years, to where it was right out there in the public, and you got to see how horrible death is.
And people loved it, and they would come out for the hanging, and they would bring their picnic lunches, and they would cheer.
And that's amazing. That just strikes me as so weird.
Well, and so when you said that, you know, if people saw the horror and had to do it themselves, my cynical thought, but I don't know that it's cynical, I think it's realistic in a way, is that there are many people who would do it.
Yeah.
Because let's not forget who is doing these lethal injections and who is overseeing them. They are doctors who have sworn the Hippocratic Oath to do no harm. And if they can purposefully kill, you know, what's to stop anybody else from doing it? Who supports it, mm-hmm. who firmly believes that it's a function of the state, that a person is guilty, and so they should just be killed, and they would be happy to throw the switch if they could throw the switch.
I think this is where really, you know, sometimes I feel guilty when I bring almost every topic back to the state and how evil the state is. Sometimes I think, you know, I've got to be driving the people around me crazy, because almost every bad thing I see, I can bring it back to the state and say, well, if the state wasn't like this or if they didn't do that, then it always comes back to that topic. And I don't know why all my friends and family haven't abandoned me out of just sheer frustration that I constantly bring things back to the state. But in my mind, what the state does is it takes on the role of God, and whatever is committed in the name of the state, it sanctions, and therefore you're not guilty of it. It's not a sin because you've done this under the name of the state.
Exactly.
So you can, as long as that state is your God, as long as you've taken this pagan idol of the, and I shouldn't even say pagan, because there are people who call themselves pagan who would never be associated with any of these activities.
Right.
The state is far beyond any thing that they would have anything to do with. So I insult pagans by even saying pagan. But people have placed the state into a position of God, and therefore their individual actions are not the actions of themselves. They're just doing what their God has had them to do. And the state takes the blame, and the state gives out forgiveness, and so they never have to face the consequences of their own sin.
The state now, in many places, is God. It is God. And you said you didn't want to say that thing about the pagans, and I don't use that word anyway. The most horrific acts done to people in the 20th century were committed by states that espoused atheism. Mm. I'm not saying that atheists are violent. I'm saying these states, in the case of Communist China and the Soviet Union, they certainly did not support religious faith. It was a case of worshiping Caesar alone.
Mm-hmm.
And they murdered, probably between the two countries, 100 million people.
Yeah.
So I grew up in a family of big government liberal Democrats, and my parents still are. And when I became a libertarian, my father told me I was a fascist, because people do not understand that if your thinking undergoes a complete change, what they call flipping to libertarianism,
mm-hmm.
Where all of a sudden you see the state in a totally different perspective,
uh-huh.
The state itself becomes the source of what is bad. Not Shell Oil.
Right, exactly.
Now, I don't like Shell Oil.
Yeah.
I think that they've done really vicious and evil things around the world.
Yeah.
But Shell Oil doesn't hold a gun to my head and force me to go to their gas stations and purchase their product.
Right.
But the U.S. government does hold a gun to my head.
Mm-hmm.
They hold a gun to my head in many ways. They hold a gun to my head at the federal, at the state, and the local level. And there's no getting away from it. There's no competition in
right.
government.
Right.
And that's actually one of the reasons why I support Ron Paul's candidacy for president, even though I don't normally vote or have anything to do with politics,
mm-hmm.
because I am so grateful to have even one person in the world who has a microphone in his face every once in a while where he actually can say that things should be given to the states. Some people are horrified by this idea, but if the states had power, we could vote with our feet,
mm-hmm.
and we could move from one state to another and find a freer state. And if the freer states got more people, then more states would become free. People have a real misunderstanding of the nature of competition and how you lose it in an overarching government like we have, and how that is what makes one of the things that makes the market system so beneficial to us is competition.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I wish that we had competition in our government, but of course we don't.
Yeah.
But what you said about going back to the thing about the state as God, you know, it's funny because, and I'm trying to remember the exact quote, but I'm not going to be able to. Where in the Bible, where God told people what would happen if
yeah.
they had a king,
yeah.
He gave them a king,
yeah.
And what they wrote in the Bible, in that Old Testament story that's mm-hmm. thousands of years old, is so true, and it teaches us a really, really important lesson, and that's that everything in the world can change. Everything can look different. Technologically, industrially, everything can improve. But human nature always stays the same.
Yeah.
And each generation must learn anew the lessons that their ancestors have learned before them.
Mm.
Because our ancestors valued liberty, and within, you know, like 150 years,
yeah.
that was utterly lost.
Yeah.
And how far will we have to go now to how far down the road to tyranny do we have to go now before people will finally have had enough and stand up and say, you know, that we're not going to take it? I don't know.
Yeah, I think of that in the sense of you mentioned your family earlier and your grandfather. My grandfather lived in eastern Kentucky, and he was your typical what folks nowadays would call a hillbilly. He
right.
he was a railroad man all his working years, but he carried a little .32 caliber pistol in his trouser pocket all of his life, and not because he was a threat to anyone or anyone was a threat to him. It was just a part of life in eastern Kentucky, you know. In the Appalachians, sometimes there's a snake, you need to shoot a snake, or,
right.
you know, whatever. In his case, he liked to fish, so he would often walk along creek banks, and when a snapping turtle would pop its head up, he would quick draw that little .32 pistol out of his pocket and shoot the turtle's head off. And anybody who has played around with pistols very much knows that that's no small feat.
Right.
But I think of my grandfather. And I think, you know, if he was to have to go through an airport nowadays, the revolution, so to speak, would start that moment.
Well, my father, since 9/11, has refused to fly.
Mm-hmm.
And he has not refused to fly because he's afraid.
Right.
He's refused to fly because he refuses to be treated like a criminal.
Yeah, I'm in that camp. I won't fly.
A few years ago, Bob and I traveled to Turkey for a meeting that he went to. And on our way back, the security was so horrendous at every airport, but most especially at Charles de Gaulle in Paris. It was just so horrific. It was unbearable. At that point, I looked at him and I said, yeah, I'm never flying again.
Mm-hmm.
As long as I live, I'm never, ever, ever flying again. I'm
yeah.
never going to stand in a line for 2 hours. See, this was the deal. I like to take pictures with film.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a film person. I have a digital camera and a film camera. But when you travel with film, you have to carry a lead bag because otherwise they'll ruin your film when they run it through an X-ray machine.
Uh-huh.
And so I always am used to, I have to put it out there. I say, I have a film bag here. It's going to show up as a big black picture on your screen, and it's film.
Mm-hmm.
And it does. If you look at the screen, it's a solid black image going across the screen, and it's not a small film bag. It holds about 20 rolls of film.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're standing there literally for 2 hours in line to go through security. And do you know, they put that lead film bag through that X-ray machine, and they didn't even notice that there was a big giant black thing that they could see through. And they just handed me my stuff and let me go.
Oh.
And you know, I security theater is exactly the right phrase because it's ridiculous. Unfortunately, you know, I had to fly again. For a year I didn't fly, and it did inspire me to take my younger daughter, who was 12 at the time, to go on a road trip. We drove from Louisiana, stopping many places along the way, all the way up to Niagara Falls, and came back down, stopping at many places, and coming back home for 2 weeks. We drove, and this would have I would have never done this, mm-hmm. but for my pact with myself that I was never going to fly again. Mm-hmm. But my daughter, who was living in New York City at the time, my older daughter, she was like, "What do you mean you're not coming up? What do you mean?" My love for my daughter outweighed my desire to stay away from the security, but I still do. I don't go through the backscatter machine. I would rather be groped. In fact, I was really horrified when they introduced that bill in the Texas legislature to ban groping by the TSA of passengers, because if they ban groping, then we're going to all have to go through the machine.
Yeah.
And I don't know about other people, but frankly, I would rather be groped than trust the state mm-hmm. to maintain a high-tech piece of equipment with the potential to cause serious bodily harm to someone. And so I have my children groped. I am groped. I don't go through the machine. And I'm not paranoid. I know that the machine in general probably doesn't really do much to you at all. But I don't trust them to maintain those machines.
Yeah.
And so I'd rather be groped. Isn't that horrible? I have to choose. Do I want to be groped or do I want to be, you know, poisoned? What's my choice?
That's a typical thing that the state does to people constantly. Is this, you know, Harry Brown once said that the state breaks your leg, hands you a crutch, and says, "See, without me, you couldn't walk." and of course that's true. But the state is worse. The state will come to you and say, "Well, would you rather have your leg broke or would you rather have your back broke? We can accommodate you."
The thing is that people accept it. It's like the woman who was in the news just a couple of weeks ago, or maybe it was even last week. The woman who was taken off the airplane with the two Indian gentlemen because the men had gotten up to go to the bathroom. Mm. And, you know, if you get up to use the bathroom on a plane, you're a terrorist.
Yeah.
And that literally was all those men had done was gotten up to go to the bathroom.
Well,
this poor woman was taken off the plane with them. Mm-hmm. And when she was interviewed afterwards, she said, "Well, you know, the FBI guys were really nice, and I appreciate that."
Oh.
And then she said that she understood that these people were all just doing their jobs.
Oh.
Now, that argument didn't wash at Nuremberg, and it doesn't wash for me now.
No.
And she herself was a victim. She was dragged off a plane. She was forced to take her clothes off and strip searched and completely humiliated. And then, even though she wrote this long blog post about the horror of it, in the end, when she was quoted in her interview with AP, she had, like, somehow come to terms with it that they were just doing what they needed to do to protect people. And I find that most people think that way.
The level of brainwashing is just amazing.
I know it is. And back to the other subject, what I mentioned earlier about the Byrd family in Texas allowing their theology to rule their ideology. I have some really devout Roman Catholic friends, and I remember when I first met them. I had never known, even though I'm a baptized Catholic, I went to Catholic school, I grew up in a city that was predominantly Catholic, I was surrounded by Catholics, I never had known people like this. And at the time when I first met them, I was still a big liberal person. they were very, very conservative. But what I discovered was that they were only conservative up to the point where their faith taught them they were supposed to believe something different, and they did. Mm. And it was surprising to me because I had never met people who were could be so conservative about so many things. But when the Pope came out and said, this is wrong, they said, this is wrong.
Mm.
And it was really surprising to me. And I guess now thinking back on it in an ignorant way, and I was an atheist at the time. I think I became an atheist when I was about 8 or 9 years old, and I was an atheist until about 10 or 12 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was just surprising to me to come across people who took their faith so seriously that they would allow it to guide their judgment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really, really hard thing to find. There was a church in Texas a couple of years ago. I don't know how long. It's so hard to think back on time and remember how long ago things were. It could have been several years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember they had an article in the newspaper. On the 4th of July, this church had soldiers rappelling down the sides of the wall inside the church with, you know, automatic weapons slung across their backs. And I just remember being so especially horrified by this idea that that it was all right to celebrate killing inside of a Christian church.
Wow.
And that to me it's the biggest flaw in humanity.
Yeah.
Is that we're always so eager and willing to go down to our most base level, and we do it again and again, and it takes a conscious effort not to do it, and it's really, really difficult not to do it.
Yeah. Well, again, it's allowing the state to take that position of God, and then anything else, any form of religion or church association or whatever becomes secondary to that state as God. And even you mentioned the atheists, like the Chinese government and the Soviet government and so forth. Really, they're not true atheists because they have a God. It's the state.
Right. It's Caesar worship.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, they can call themselves atheists, but atheists should be embarrassed by them because they actually have a God and they call it the state.
That's why I made the point of saying that I don't believe that atheists are killers. That wasn't
right,
my
right.
point.
It
was
exactly.
It was a case of where states set themselves up
mm-hmm.
as God.
Yeah.
But that's the last 150 years
yeah.
of history is the abandonment of the idea that there is, and I'm not sure, I'm about to go into a place that I'm not really sure how I feel about it, but it, this whole idea is an abandonment of natural law. The idea that there are first principles,
mm-hmm.
that human beings are supposed to behave in certain ways,
mm-hmm.
that there are black and white issues, and this clinging to the state and the idea of the state as God came along with the abandonment of the idea that human beings are not just acting creatures,
mm-hmm.
but are moral acting creatures.
Yeah.
And I believe that no matter what your faith
mm-hmm.
or lack of faith, that if you don't carry around within you some idea, even if you fail at it every day, which
yeah.
most of us do,
yeah.
that if you don't carry around inside of you the idea that you're supposed to be a moral creature,
mm-hmm.
that we're doomed to states like the Soviets and the Chinese were,
yeah.
And the Chinese still are in many aspects.
Yeah.
I don't want to live in China. I don't want to live in the former Soviet Union.
Right. Or any modern version of it.
No, I absolutely do not. But I can recall many years ago, and this is when I was first becoming a libertarian, I can recall reading an article online about a family that they were a farming family. They were rural in China, and they already had, like, three children or something. But the one-child rule, you know, it was ignored a lot in rural areas because people needed children to work on the farm.
Mm-hmm.
And so this woman carried her baby, and when she was, I think, 8.5 months pregnant, the local council people came and told her that she had to have an abortion. And so they took her, against her will, of course, to the hospital and did whatever it is that they do. I think they shoot chemicals and things into the womb. But what happened was that the baby didn't die. She went into labor. And she gave birth to the baby live.
Mm.
And her doctor assured her that it was all, and she tried to hide with the baby in the hospital.
Mm.
And her doctor assured her that they wouldn't do anything to her baby now that her baby was born. And so she took her baby home. And just a few days later, these people showed up at her house, and they took her baby out of her arms, and in front of her, they drowned her baby in a rice paddy.
Wow.
And to me, when I read that, there was a time in my life when I would have read that and I would have said, wow, those communists, they're really horrible.
Mm-hmm.
But that wasn't the reaction I had. It was the first time in my life where I ever had the reaction that, wow, the state is really, really evil.
Yeah.
And at that point, there was no going back for me at that point.
Yeah.
I was... You know, I went further and further down the road to where I am now, where I'm pretty much a philosophical anarchist.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe that anarchy is in any way achievable goal. But I believe that anything that anyone can do to make government smaller is worthwhile and should be done.
Mm-hmm.
But I am an anarchist.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you tell people that you're an anarchist, and they automatically jump to the conclusion that you're the Molotov cocktail-throwing kind of anarchist. Because that's the only kind they know about. They don't know about the non-aggression principle or anything about that. People are heavily indoctrinated by the state, you know, especially if they go through public school.
Mm-hmm.
We're all taught that George Washington chopped down the cherry tree and he could not tell a lie.
Right.
And I remember several years ago I read this book called American Aurora. Have you ever read it?
I don't think so.
It's the most amazing history, and of course I'm not going to be able to remember the gentleman's name who wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
He is an independent scholar. I believe the book won the Bancroft Prize, and it actually deserved it. It's the story of the founding of the country as told through the newspapers that were allied with the different political factions of the time.
Uh-huh.
And the American Aurora was the newspaper that was owned by Benny Beach, who was the grandson of Benjamin Franklin.
Mm.
Benjamin Franklin had willed his printing press to his grandson,
uh-huh.
who had been schooled by small R Republicans in Switzerland while Benjamin Franklin was living in France. And he was a staunch small R Republican. And he started this newspaper. They were Jeffersonians. And in this book, the author uses articles and commentaries from the newspaper, letters that people were writing at the time, letters by, you know, the parties themselves. And while this was a complete revisionist history, and we know he left a lot of things out and painted things the way he wanted them to be painted, there was still a lot to be learned from it. And from reading this book, I discovered that at the time, many people who knew George Washington thought he was an idiot.
Mm-hmm.
Even the people who were on his side said that he was an idiot.
Yeah.
That he couldn't even write his own letters, that Alexander Hamilton had to write his letters because he couldn't write well enough to write his own letters. And John Adams in a letter said that no matter what, the history of George Washington had to be the history that they were writing about him.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember reading this and just being so stunned and so amazed, because, you know, it's like this hero worship stuff on the level of God that we're taught in
yeah.
school. And all of a sudden I'm reading about how these people actually really were, and they're so totally in conflict with how
mm-hmm.
With how they were in real life. I mean, they're not even the same people. But unless you actually seek out this information, which probably only 1/1000th of 1% of the population of this country would do,
mm-hmm.
You only know what they teach you in school and what your parents teach you and the stories that are handed down. And so nobody knows these things. They look at the founding fathers as if they're gods. See the founding fathers, many of them anyway, as completely immoral, evil people. They
mm-hmm.
were slaveholders. They were slave rapists.
Yeah.
They, and of course, they weren't all.
Right.
And I know that what I'm saying will horrify some people that I'm even saying this, but there's this poster going around on Facebook today about Ronald Reagan meeting with the Taliban.
Yeah, I saw that.
Saying that they're, you know, the moral equivalent of the founding fathers or
yeah.
something. And they were. In many ways, they actually were.
Yeah.
Not all of them, maybe not even most of them.
Mm-hmm.
But there were many people, many of our founding fathers, who were certainly morally challenged at best.
Yeah.
And so I just kind of have a whole different attitude about everything having to do with the state
yeah.
in its entirety.
Yeah, I went off on a rant, I think it was yesterday, this would be Thursday or Friday's podcast, I can't remember which now, I was talking, and I kind of went off on a rant because a friend of mine, a guy that I have a lot of respect for, had made the statement that, you know, if we could just get back to the Republic, and if we could just get back to following the Constitution. And in my podcast, the rant that I went off on, and my listeners are like, right now they're hearing this and they're saying, why do we have to listen to this again? But but the rant that I went off on was, are you talking about our original republic, our constitution, the one that within the first presidency, George Washington used an excuse of a battle in the old Northwest Territory to, against the Constitution, have Congress fund for him an army that he told them he was going to take into the old Northwest and fight, and instead he went into Pennsylvania to attack tax protesters.
Right.
Now, that was in the first term of the first president. The ink on the document was still wet, practically.
Right.
And they're violating
it. And the second president was the Alien Sedition Act.
Exactly.
And the third president, who many, many libertarians revere, Thomas mm-hmm. Jefferson, and he unconstitutionally bought Louisiana.
Yeah.
There was nothing in the Constitution that allowed him to do that, but he did it anyway. Not that I'm objecting on, you know, some principle that he shouldn't have bought Louisiana,
right.
but from the very beginning,
yeah,
there was...
We either have the rules or we don't have the rules.
It was a very, you know, easy willingness to just do whatever it was that they wanted to do.
Yeah. Yeah, and as a matter of fact, he actually, by sending Lewis and Clark, I did another article on this, by sending Lewis and Clark on the expedition that he did, he actually took ownership of property that he didn't even buy from Napoleon, that Spain was claiming part of it, Russia was claiming part of it, and England was claiming part. But by sending Lewis and Clark, he basically said, well, we're taking it now.
Well, you know, the history of the United States, and this is a whole different podcast, and you'll need to get an expert on this, somebody else to discuss this. The whole history of the United States is a big land grab.
Yeah.
you know, and land schemes. I read this book about George Washington's involvement in this dismal swamp company where they were going to sell all this swamp property. And, and I mean, the whole thing is just, you know, grabbing land. And anyway.
And that's what the state does. It's Murray Rothbard said, well, he may have been quoting somebody else, but he said that the state is just a gang of thieves. That's all they are.
I think it was Augustine.
Oh, well, yes.
Augustine, the theologian.
Yeah, compared to pirates and pirates and emperors. Is that, have you seen the little video?
Yeah, that's, you know, it's what I said, you know, a little while ago, that, you know, that human nature stays the same.
Mm-hmm.
It just stays the same. And that's, I think, what's hard for people who actually think about these, who think about these things.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Elizabeth, for coming on BadQuaker.com with me, and thank you for your time to give us this interview. It's really been a pleasure to talk to you. And open invitation to come back on, and of course, we have talked about having your husband on. Robert Higgs, like I said in the beginning, is a respected member of the Liberty Movement and has done foundational work in economics, and we sure hope to get him on the show at some point in time. And until that time, or until we can get you back on the show again, Elizabeth, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you for having me. It was very interesting.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Bye.